Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Freedom Talk Radio with your host, Andy Peacher.
You're listening to Jane Gotti Jr. Show on Freedom Talk Radio.
Whoops, the wrong jingle. sorry about that. That's our spiritual guy on a Saturday night. It's 12 noon Eastern and 8 p.m. UK. James Gold Jr. speaks about quantum physics. We speak about his books. It's a fantastic show, that one. It's really took me into spiritual heaven, literally. But anyway, yeah, we're back with author Timothy Spearman, Shakespeare.com. He's had a screenplay. By the way, Tim, how has the screenplay progressed before we move on to the rest of the show? Pardon me.
You mean the screenplay that I'm working on now?
No, the Titanic radio show, I should say.
Oh, well, I'm hoping that we can make a film about the Titanic and the USS Liberty, and I'm hoping we can make them concurrently. I'm thinking of that possibility. So the screenplay for the USS Liberty is done, but we're going to work on it some more and edit it and get it into the kind of shape that the man behind the scenes, Dave, would like to have it. Because he wrote the book, Erasing the Liberty, and we want to make sure that the screenplay and the film reflect the same message and get across what we want. So, yeah, it's coming along, Andy.
I was thinking, we're always called fools ourselves, aren't we? And if people look at the website, Shakespeare.com, /biblical Titanic Ship of Fools, the Ship of Fools radio play was an excellent way of showing where, you know, this time it's not the people that are the fools, it's the people on the ship, or the people who are making us think that this ship, sank. Due to this, that, and the other reason. But, yeah, so I love you as an author. I love John because John Hamer was very similar in doing, you know, different things, similar to you and similar to other people because, let's face it, we're all talking about the same thing. So his falsification of history book, just one of them because can't remember everyone, you know, it tells you very similar, really, what we're talking about tonight. You know, they're trying to tell us this is happening, that's happening, but really, no, you've got to ask questions. Definitely got to ask questions. And I've got a couple of clips to play when you're ready, either now or later. Aleister Crowley was Winston Churchill, and Dwight, I forgot the second name, was Clark Gable.
Yeah, Dwight Eisenhower, the president. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be interesting because we know Clark Gable obviously was in all these films.
Gone with the Wind. Yeah.
Yeah. Gone with the Wind, is that a clue? and also, I can't think of where I was going on that one, but we often get told, especially through Disney, that's it. The kids who watch Disney, you know, it's a wonderful world out there and we're just people that are doing this Disney film. But really, there's a thing behind Disney, isn't there, that's not very nice. So, again, it may not be a false flag terror event, but it's a kind of a false flag film that depicts what's really going on in the world.
Go for it.
All right, then we'll play Dwight Eisenhower was Clark Gable first, and then you can give your comments, and then we'll play the other one. Aleister Crowley was Winston Churchill, so we'll see you in 10 minutes.
Was Ronald Reagan really the first actor president? Was he the first president who we had spent years learning to like on the big screen before they were elected to preside over the small one? Or had that brilliant behaviorist scheme already been tested on a subliminal level with the man known as the King of Hollywood? What was it about Eisenhower that inspired such enormous landslides? An interesting theory of 50s nostalgia is suggested by a character in Ross Thomas's novel Missionary Stew. I think it was Gable, mostly. Clark Gable? Right, Hare said. If you closed your eyes when Eisenhower talked, he sounded exactly like Clark Gable. That must have been really reassuring to most people. Indeed. And how fortuitous for Ike, unless that effect was by design. Either way, the same thing is noted in essays on Eisenhower at Fort Lewis, and his D-Day radio address, and a PBS biopic, and by impressionist Will Jordan, and other commenters.
In better company.
In company with our those brave allies and brothers in arms
and
on
don't
other
think
fronts,
they are dishing out,
you will
too.
Bring about the destruction of
any
the German
kid
war
who
machine.
Can handle himself,
the elimination
and
of Nazi tyranny over the
American
oppressed peoples of Europe.
Shape.
But as you can see, the resemblance doesn't require closed eyes. Saturday Review critic Hollis Alpert wrote about 1958's Teacher's Pet that Mr. Gable looks and sounds a little too much like President Eisenhower. Too much for comfort, or too much to be a coincidence? Hallucinatory or not, this resemblance could only amplify what official history tells us, that Ike was the first presidential candidate to be mass-marketed in the pop culture celebrity style, complete with cartoon TV ads. Even before he agreed to run, a hit Broadway song, They Like Ike, was drilling his campaign slogan into the public head, building up to a big midnight rally at Madison Square Garden, which featured many celebrities, including Clark Gable. Apparently, it was very important that Ike be endorsed by the King of Hollywood himself, as he had to violate his contract with MGM in order to participate in the televised event. He reportedly spoke with the absent general over the phone, urging him to run, but Eisenhower's biographies make no mention of him participating in the rally. Instead, it was a film of the event flown to Europe for him to watch, which affected him profoundly and finally convinced him to run. Warren Harris's 2002 biography claims that Gable, quote, revered Eisenhower and had met him several times during his Air Force service, end quote, but there's nothing about these alleged meetings in that section or anywhere else. According to local historians, they were both in Bangor Bay, County Down, Ireland on May 19th, 1944, but no hint of a meeting. Gable and Eisenhower are often described as close friends or pals when recounting a chummy get-welligram Gable is said to have received from Ike after his 1960 heart attack. But David Brett's 2007 biography stresses that, quote, Clark and the president had not been on first-name terms. There was no telegram, end quote. Instead, there was a very different half-formal letter. For some reason, the substance of this letter was rewritten for popular memory with a heavy spin of familiarity and presented as fact rather than rumor. So there are false claims of friendship, uncertain accounts of interactions, and rumors of meetings with no source. But wait! What about this? Yes, there is this image of a meeting. The story of this image is that it's an image without a story, apart from one unsourced, unfootnoted paragraph in Christopher Spicer's 2002 bio, a strange little story which also claims that they met during the war, with no further detail. There's no reference to this White House meeting in any other biography of either man. The given date, April 2, 1958, is an otherwise prominent one in Eisenhower's story. That was the day he gave a big speech to Congress proposing a civilian space agency. The NASA we know and trust was officially born a few months later, but it was conceived the day that these two allegedly met. Not only is this highly intriguing, it makes it all the more odd that meeting with the president on such a historic day would not be worth mentioning anywhere else. Why are there so many contradictory and unsourced claims about a personal relationship between these two? Can you think of a reason for that very specific pattern of misdirection? Eisenhower was a major American face of the war, and so was Gable. Not just any celebrity soldier, the King of Hollywood was making recruitment films. He was not just any patriotic enlistee, but a grieving widower whose wife was the first lady casualty of the war. She died in a plane crash while on tour selling war bonds, leaving him a really ripping motivational backstory for his military service. But before the public saw Gable narrating war documentaries that he had shot himself while risking his life in the thick of battle, they saw him play a newsreel reporter who fakes war footage in Too Hot to Handle. One of his classmates from officer training remembers how he won them over. Quote, "We began to realize he was the real McCoy. But still, you'd say to yourself, only an actor can act the way he does. The day he arrived, he had more military bearing than most of the men had when they left, partly because of his natural posture, and partly because he was an actor, I'm sure." Gable's own accounts of his early life are considered unreliable by his biographers, who describe contradictory records of his name at birth, contradictory records of his mother's cause of death, contradictory stories about his years after dropping out of high school, including rumors he worked for the mob in Akron, contradictory records of his age when he was first married. Gable once told an interviewer that the studios don't allow actors to reveal their year of birth. Their true age was officially a mystery. It's perhaps relevant that Gable's father, quote, "belonged to the Freemasons and swore by its credos," according to Harris. Clark became a Mason at age 33, we think. When he died, just a few days after Ike's successor was elected, he insisted on a closed casket. On May 6th of 1952, Gable announced he'd be away in Europe for a year and a half, just as Eisenhower was returning from Europe to launch his presidential campaign on June 4th. Eisenhower's support had been built in his absence. After winning the nomination, he let his campaign managers choose his running mate and his entire cabinet for him. Was that because he was an indecisive Libra? Or because he was only the front man, figurehead face of someone else's political experiment? Gable is said to have personally desegregated the set of Gone with the Wind by threatening to quit. President Eisenhower immediately desegregated everything under his direct authority, the military, Washington, D.C., federally funded schools, before the Supreme Court started that process on a state level in 1954. They both played bridge and golf, both hit their only hole-in-one on the 13th hole. They both enjoyed shooting skeet and were very good baseball hitters as young men. They both had big stick-out ears. That's important. It should go without saying that the shape of the ear is one of the easiest things to alter, since it doesn't impede speech or facial expression. There are differences here, but it's a difference of degree, not difference in kind. They have the same kind of ears, the big stick-out kind. Lots of people noticed the voice. One critic noticed the face, but there's another famous writer who mentions these two together. David frickin' Bowie. In Planet of Dreams from the Long Live Tibet Benefit album, he sings, "You see I got Gable's eyes, and Eisenhower blames the poor." Eisenhower was president when the Dalai Lama escaped Tibet. That could explain mentioning him, maybe. But why mention Gable in the same breath? Is this why? We're backing up a major plan. We're treading on thin ice. The song fades out, repeating, "We're living in a planet of dreams." Couldn't agree more.
I guess sometimes that's how you have to live in a planet of dreams, because if you didn't have a dream or some kind of ambition or wishes and wants, you know, what would the world be? I think sometimes dreams get you by, but then he was probably referring to dreams in a different context. But there you go. Would you mind, Tim, if shortly we get our friend Stashon from Oregon? I'm not sure if you've ever spoken to him, but he's just good at this US-UK stuff.
Sure, no problem.
Yeah, and I'm not sure where Clark Gable's going to... Not Clark Gable, sorry. I'm not sure where Winston Churchill's going to end up, but it's a fascinating topic, this is. And I think the video is just threw in, you know, an extra concept to what we were doing. You know, and as it does when there's one or two people on or three, and you get a video or two, and before you know it, you know, the show's kind of ended. So, I'll bring on Stash because he is a long time friend, and I did say I'd try and get him on for a little while today.
Just sure.
Just to liven things up from Portland. Oh, yeah, that reminds me, Portland, Oregon. It's just a coincidence that I love the Empire Builder Trainer. I've never been on that, but I've watched millions of videos. I've been on all the other ones, the Chicago to LA and LA to Miami, Orlando and the New York to Chicago. But I always wanted to do the Empire Builder because. Stash, any comments on the show so far? And it's not, you're not allowed to say rubbish.
Oh, if you're going to take trains, by the way, you have to take the city of New Orleans, Chicago down to New Orleans. That's a great train. As far as all these false flags, what amazes me is how careless they've become with their detail. I mean, I have seen the Craigslist ads calling for crisis actors. I mean, come on, how more blatant can you be? Little things like when on 9/11, when they came in to tell George Bush about the towers being hit, he's sitting there reading an upside down book with kids, and they didn't rush him off to Air Force One. That was a dead giveaway. Sandy Hook, why did they destroy the school? Where are the bodies? Where are the death certificates? Where's all the proof of these things? They're so good at covering them up. And, you know, it's just become so obvious in all of these things. As soon as some big political event that might hurt the deep state comes up, they come up with an event to turn the press the other way. And every time one of these things happens, my first question, of course, is what are they really up to? What are they trying to cover up? What are they trying to hide by doing this? So that's just my initial statement.
Yeah, I mean, Tim can comment in a second, but now let Tim comment now, because I wanted to ask you, what did you think of New Zealand? But yeah, Tim, comment on what Stash has just said, and Tim, hello to Stash,
yeah.
And vice versa.
Hi, Stash. Yeah, I mean, good comment. About Sandy Hook, you were talking about that one. The coroner, Carver, as he was rather appropriately called, his name is family name Carver. He gave a press conference, which was absolutely, I don't know if you saw that, Sasha, but it was incredibly revealing, because if he was a coroner, then I should sign up to be a coroner as well, because he didn't seem to know anything about the profession, and he didn't seem to know anything about the case. He also claimed that the families had not been shown the bodies, but only photographs of their dead children. Well, you can't do that. That's unlawful, and if there's any truth to the claim, then they broke every legal protocol going, because you have to show the corpus delicti to the relatives, because it's part of determining proof that a homicide has actually taken place. So just amazing revelations in that regard. And also, just, he didn't seem to know anything about anything. And so when he was asked questions, he hummed and hawed and just seemed to be stuck for words and gave all kinds of ridiculous replies. And he was asked about the shooting assailant, and he said, "Oh, I haven't examined him yet." And he was asked how many victims there were, and he didn't seem to know. So, have you seen that video? Have you seen the interview with the chief coroner?
I did see it, and you know, sort of an analogy I have, as I've said often, if I ever have to go for vocational rehab, I want to be a meteorologist in Oregon. Where else can I get paid big bucks for not knowing anything? Same kind of thing, you know.
I tell you what's interesting, on Sandy Hook, and sorry to interrupt, Stash, I did read tonight, because of looking at it tonight for this show, and I was quite amazed. People are publishing from the alternative media, the so-called, the alternative media, the people are telling people lies against the national mainstream, but we're not. But I've seen publications of loan agreements, bank statements, school enrollments from all these people who are supposed to be in dead at Sandy Hook. You know, they've took out, died today, and the same person took out a mortgage the next day. So that is obviously, I've seen the, I know documents can be falsified as well, but so can the statements from the officials as well. And I think the James Fetz has written a book, isn't he? So he, nobody died at Sandy Hook, or at least that's his common statement anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're notorious for never following their own laws. I mean, look at the political circus in D.C. right now. I never have to buy another ticket for a P.T. Barnum show. I mean, because there's enough of a circus on the internet just watching these clowns play their games. And it's, as I was saying before, about the details. Little things that, no, you can't go out and take out a mortgage tomorrow in your own name because you're supposed to be dead. Excuse me, you know, we're going to have to change your name or something. But they never do that. Over.
Yeah, so the bad liars really, Stash. Tim, let's go back because the name of the show tonight, New Zealand Mosque False Flag Exposed. The reason being, I was going to play a video which would highlight this very well. It's okay, we get busy, sidetracked, that's fine. But I think, me personally, you know, like a lot of these critics, they say, well, I'm not convinced on this one. You know, I let's face it, 9/11 was easy to be convinced on. You know, Sandy Hook, wasn't sure, let's see what happens. The other ones in Britain, straight away, you knew that was 7/7 was a definite, you know, false flag. And a few of them, you think, could that be a false flag or not? Well, anyway, this video describes that every October and every March in the dark calendar, let's call it Satan's calendar for argument's sake, that's not the right word, but March and October, they always stage something. It doesn't have to happen in October. Often it can happen in September or early November, March, April. It could happen in February. But all these false flags seem to have a thing in common. But anyway, you know, they happen that time of the year. But in particular, New Zealand, there was the Max 3 jet went down in September or October last year. And then 3 weeks later, you had the Pittsburgh shooting. And it's the same with, you know, now we had the Max 3 plane. Can't remember where it was now because I try to get my facts together. But then 3 weeks later, the New Zealand shooting. So, coincidence or what? Or not?
If I may.
Yeah, go on then, Tim. We've got to quarter to the hour anyway.
There is a global movement of the, and I hate to keep using this term, deep state, shadow governments, all that. There is a major move all over the world to disarm Americans. Every time there is a shooting anywhere, even in New Zealand, the gun grabbers in America are out there in force. Look, 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 see, if there weren't guns, this wouldn't happen. Well, if there was somebody in there with a gun who knew how to use it, somebody might have shot the shooter before he killed all those people. Hmm. Oh, well, we can't tell you that. No, no, no. He had a gun. Guns are the problem. So, you know, we got to take away everybody's guns. And as you can probably tell, I'm a hardcore Second Amendment proponent for the American Constitution, because the Second Amendment protects all our other rights from a government coming in and just taking, a dictatorial government coming in and taking over. It is our only defense. So that's what, to me, that was all about. I may be wrong, but that was the first thing that hit my mind. The gun grabbers came out of the woodwork. Over.
Tim?
They opportunistically seize upon this issue of gun control and gun confiscation, and certainly the UN has an agenda to see to it that the world is disarmed. And so what the ultimate end goal is seemingly to enslave the population. America is important because once America falls, then everything else falls in this deck of cards. So they plan on gaining control over the United States through the gun control, gun confiscation legislation, and then impose martial law upon the United States. All of these false flag terror operations involving shooting have had as their agenda the invoking of gun confiscation legislation. And it has always been on the table the very next day after the shooting. It's either proposed or there's an attempt to enact legislation and get the game going. New Zealand has a powerful gun lobby, and it has similar situation as the United States, where guns and private gun ownership is widespread, and most New Zealanders want to keep it that way. So I also found it suspicious that we had a mosque shooting here in Canada about 6 months ago, and the premier, her name is Wynne, she's no longer in office, she had a veil on and attended the funeral, and it's exactly the same playbook replayed in New Zealand with the reaction of the prime minister. And immediately what's called for gun control legislation, gun confiscation legislation, and she didn't want the name of the alleged assailant to be used because she claims that she doesn't wish to have him glorified or infamous though he is. She doesn't want him to gain any public attention whatsoever. She thereby protects him because people will forget who he is, and probably he'll enter into a witness protection program and end up as an agent somewhere else and be recycled in some future event. So I find it telling that the MI6 had a dossier on him. Is he one of their boys? Is he MK Ultra mind control sleeper agent? Was he already on their books? Was he one of their boys? I wouldn't be at all surprised. Strangely, also, there was an earthquake just prior to the event in New Zealand, and it actually exposed the fact that Mossad was there undertaking some kind of covert operation because the earthquake somehow exposed their presence, and that came out in the media as well. Andy, are you there? Hello?
No, I'm here. I'm just thinking, wow. Yeah. Wow.
You just validated everything I was saying, and their playbook has become so obvious. I mean, they don't deviate from it, and you see the same things over and over again, and they're not working, and that's a big thing.
Yeah, agreed. It's so true, and I don't know where the lack of imagination comes from. I imagine it's because they keep things close to the vine. They don't like to bring in a lot of extra people, so they keep recycling the same program with the same people over and over again. And if you only have so many planners in the room, then obviously the same ideas are going to get rehashed quite a bit. And so they keep using the same script.
Well, I'm just going to read the show headline tonight that I got from 153news.net. That's 153news.net. They've got a video on this, and this is the one I was going to play. And it says, regarding New Zealand, everything points to a real mass shooting that did occur, but a fake video was also produced as a separate psy-op before the terrorist attack even took place. Intelligence analyst and former military officer says every American patriot only needs to consider the highly restrictive gun control laws that were enacted in Scotland after the Dunblane school shooting and in Australia immediately following the Port Arthur massacre. The Dunblane mass shooting took place on the 13th of March 1996, and the Port Arthur massacre occurred from 28th, 29th of April 1996, it quickly became obvious to gun owners worldwide that these two nefarious psychops were staged within 2 months of each other with purposeful political design a la Operation Gladio. In both cases, draconian gun control legislation was passed that effectively stripped the citizenry of their right to possess firearms. That's it.
You know, and another side of this is it's not just that they're limited in their players. They don't believe they'll ever be caught or they'll ever go to trial. They believe they're above the law because for them there is no law. But that's quickly coming to an end in the United States, and we're watching politician after politician go down, and there's going to be a lot more real soon. Over.
Yeah, Stash is a Trump supporter, and to be fair, I'm a Trump supporter as well. No,
I'm not. I'm glad he's in there. I'm glad he's doing what he's doing, but I'm still taking the same kind of attitude with him that I took with Obama. We'll see.
Yeah, you're in the middle like everyone else.
Yeah, I'm a hardcore middle of the rotor. Neither side has all the right answers. And a bird takes two wings to fly, left and right. Over.
Yeah, the only thing just on that note alone, I mean, he's doing more than others did, but he's still, that makes him middle of the road. He's not delivered everything he promised. But then that's good, that's a start, because over here, they've never delivered anything they promised. I mean, they can't even work out whether to leave Europe or stay in Europe. I mean, the people want to leave, and it's the politicians that want to stay because of, some kind of greedy lifestyle they have. Anyway.
Yep.
Over. Well, not so much over, but Tim, we've been talking about these sort of things, haven't we, for years on Orion Talk Radio and on Freedom Talk Radio, and wouldn't it be nice one day if we could just wake up and talk about how wonderful the world is for change? Stash is grinding his coffee on his place, what do they call it, veranda, sitting outside his little lake there, having his coffee and his sandwich, whatever. There's Troy, you know, Matheson, another good friend of ours. He's happy doing what he does with his computers and his websites. And Tim, he's selling loads of books because he's a fabulous author. And Andy, you know, they can shut him up because there's nothing to talk about. But, you know, but in reality, none of this is going to happen, is it?
Oh, that's hilarious, Andy.
It's a great British sense of humor.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we wouldn't know what to do if the world was all peachy and keen, you know? I mean, we'd just be sitting here twiddling our thumbs. Oh, boy, what do I do next? What do I want to do? I can do it. Wow. That's crazy. Just crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, here we are. There is an old Chinese curse, which I'm familiar, or I'm quite fond of repeating, because we're living it. It says, may you live in interesting times. Mm-hmm. Is that an understatement or what?
Yeah, it's certainly getting interesting. Never more so than now. Andy, thanks a lot for having me on today. It's been great to see you again on the monitor and hear your voice. And I hope that package arrives soon, and keep me posted. And let's do another show soon, brother.
Yeah, we're still on air, Tim. But yeah, what I'll do then, that's fine. And thanks, Seth, for coming on. I'll play as much as I can then of Aleister Crowley was Winston Churchill, just to wrap up the last 9 minutes.
Okay.
That's brilliant.
Nice to meet you, Sasha, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, Stash. Yeah, S-T-A-S-H.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Stash, sorry.
Stash,
all right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we didn't find the good stuff.
He stashes the coffee everywhere.
That's
Is it,
it
the story
yeah.
of the soldier and the hunchback? The connection between the worlds of intelligence and the occult should go without saying, but there are many things to say. In England, it's a very well-established fact, dating back to Elizabeth I and her court astrologer, Dr. John Dee, the original 007 who coined the term the British Empire. It is equally well-established that Aleister Crowley worked for British intelligence, although his intelligence role is thought to be much more modest and peripheral than Dr. Dee's. It is generally accepted as plausible, sometimes presented as established fact, that Crowley had enough influence to have his proposed anti-swastika power symbol, the V for victory, adopted by Churchill himself. Crowley's connections were to naval intelligence, and Churchill was the First Lord of the Admiralty during World War I, so he would have been Crowley's direct superior when Crowley was loudly pretending to be anti-British in New York. In the States, the Office of Naval Intelligence is associated with the fake counterculture of the Laurel Canyon scene, which is also associated with the V sign. So, it's accepted that there were very few degrees of separation between these luminaries, but no suggestion of a meeting, which is a bit surprising since they had rather a lot in common. Churchill is also known as a drug addict, for one thing. He was a Freemason, naturally, but had you heard that Churchill was initiated as a druid? Did you know he had a reputation for being psychic? His intuition supposedly saved his own life or the lives of others on 3 separate occasions. So Churchill was rocking some unexpectedly Crowleyan attributes. Meanwhile, Crowley told a friend he felt responsible for the sinking of the Lusitania. He was working his occult contacts to persuade the Germans to be belligerent, while Churchill took more concrete steps to make such an accidental drowning of neutral passengers much more likely, as part of their shared mission to embroil America in Europe's Great War. Their efforts appear to have paid off, but Crowley's influence on the course of the war may go further than that. He is said to have led a divination ritual in 1910 at the request of another Admiralty agent, Commander Marston, which predicted that wars with Germany and Turkey would begin within 5 years, and that both of those countries would be destroyed. Turned out to be pretty accurate. In the novel Moonchild, Crowley's avatar Simon If dismisses everyone who thinks they know why World War I started and says it was, quote, I who made it, explaining that it is a necessary catalyst for the emergence of the new aeon. Even more relevant are Crowley's short stories featuring Simon If as a sleuth who not only solves crimes, but sometimes colludes with journalists and law enforcement to cover up the truth, promising, I will arrange with the consulate for secrecy. He concludes another case by musing that they should install the murderer as Minister for Education. It's implied he could perhaps actually arrange for this as a revered senior member of the local elite secret society, the Hemlock Club. Elsewhere, Simon If has enough pull with the Admiralty to borrow a top-secret advanced vehicle just so he can create a puzzle for his friend. In short, Simon If has the sensibility of Crowley and the connections of Churchill. The suspicious accuracy of Crowley's World War I prediction is nothing compared to a Simon If tale of high political intrigue titled A Sense of Incongruity, which features a plot against America by what was, at the end of World War I, when the story was written, a very unlikely alliance of Austria and Japan, which turned out to be a big bullseye, Hitler being from Austria. But what if I told you this story ends after Dr. Nagasaki is destroyed by a new and, quote, intensely radioactive weapon? Which is, of course, precisely what happens on the last page of World War II. 5 years is one thing, 20 to 25 years ahead of time is quite another. Just how psychic was this guy supposed to be? Or, if the script for the next war was set that far in advance, why would a supposedly lowly agent like Crowley know all about it? The editor, William Breeze, is startled, obviously, and describes Crowley as, quote, eerily prescient. It's really another way of saying coincidence theory. Could there be a more direct connection here? Mr. Breeze also says it should awaken the sense of incongruity in any attentive reader, which is curious since, in the story, Simon If initially exposes the plot by noticing a telltale facial feature, quote, that only grows on one family face on the planet, end quote, thus recognizing a famous European aristocrat who's slumming it undercover in New York on a secret mission to start a war. Simon If's sense of incongruity is awakened by facial recognition. Naturally, Simon If prefers his heroic role to remain secret, asking, do you want me pilloried as a meddlesome Matty in the next number of Life? Interesting, since meddlesome Matty was the phrase Teddy Roosevelt used to refer to the U.S. getting involved in foreign conflicts, which is exactly the mission Crowley had been secretly working to accomplish in New York. So he was writing about his own intelligence work. The question is, was he also an aristocrat in disguise? Relevant to this question is one of the non-Simon If stories, titled Colonel Pacton's Brother. It features a group of spiritualist grifters attempting to con the visiting Earl of Grantchester, a character who is said to be based on Everard Fielding, an investigator of seances and trance mediums, who was also the man who recruited Crowley for secret work in 1914, according to Richard Spence. Their plan, the grifters, is foiled when it turns out that they were talking to someone else all along, a character said to be based on Crowley, who was posing as the aristocrat. One conspirator reproaches the other that they did every kind of detailed research about their mark, but never bothered to look at his picture. Ask yourself, have you done every kind of detailed research about these people except for looking at their pictures? Is that something people can be counted on to miss? As Crowley wrote elsewhere, investigation of spiritualism makes a capital training ground for Secret Service work. One soon gets up to all the tricks. There's much more of interest in Crowley's short fiction, but for now, I'll just note that one of the centerpiece myth arc episodes of the Simon If in America collection, the Pasquani Puzzle, is about a doppelganger. This book is about a celebrity traveling undercover, who also has a doppelganger, but it was written by a different Winston Churchill. So, never mind. The respectable journalism about Crowley's intelligence career tends to conclude that his claimed involvements were not only plausible, but understated, the question being, how much? It is, of course, easy and reasonable to assume that Simon If represents Crowley indulging his fantasy superego rather than venting his true autobiography in